Alright, everybody, welcome to the September 16th edition of Cascadian Views. We got the whole crew here. Dan, JJ, how's your week going?
Hello. I'm doing well.
So far, alright. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think the big story, at least in terms of what the national media is covering this week, is Trump's try to become a Democrat. It might be a fair way of putting that. The Trump train has barreled into Chuck and Nancy Station and is making some deals. First, it was the debt ceiling. We discussed that previously. Now, apparently, there's some work to be done on tax reform. The president had both Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi in for dinner. And then a hot mic on C-SPAN caught Chuck Schumer telling the other Democrats that Trump really likes them, or at the very least likes him. What is there to this? Is he starting to see that Democrats can deliver votes, whereas Republicans can't? Is it solely to piss off the Republicans who are, you know, chopping at him? How should we read that?
I can't imagine that it's to deliver votes, just because at this point, I don't see how they can deliver votes. I mean, they're still the minority party, and if Paul Ryan or Mitch McConnell doesn't want to bring up for business any particular agreement that Trump reaches with the Democrats, you know, they can block it out. You know, it's just that simple. So I'm not sure really what he's trying to do with this. It's very strange to me.
I feel like he just wants a new group of people to compliment him and try to kiss his ass.
Yeah.
There was
I think genuinely, yeah, frustrating Mitch McConnell is. I mean, at this point, it's easy for Trump, and so it's probably a lot of fun.
Yeah, he's gotten bored with that dude, basically. There was one story I've seen today that I guess he was having trouble making small talk with Mitch, but apparently he gets along great with Chuck Schumer, so that's driving a lot of this, apparently. Just personality. He's just gotten tired of these other guys.
There was he's just dating somebody new. It's fine.
Yeah.
Josh Marshall on Talking Points Memo pointed out something that I thought actually went pretty far to explain a lot of this. That is, Trump sees Schumer and Pelosi as opposing equals, basically, whereas he looks at McConnell and Ryan more as bulking employees.
I could see that. I could kind of understand why he might look at it that way. Sure.
Yeah, there is dealing to be made with Schumer, with Pelosi, whereas Ryan and McConnell are just people he's in charge of that aren't doing what they're told.
Yeah.
It's just a frustration because they can't do what he wants them to.
Yeah, I've made a hostile takeover of this party, and these managers from the previous regime are not doing what I'm telling them. And clearly, it's just because they're reluctant to do it. It's not a matter of he's trying to do things that break the party in half.
Well, I mean, they do suck.
Well, yes. They're very bad. Well, Ryan, I think, is bad at his job. McConnell is ordinarily a very shrewd legislative tactician. I think he's just been trying to do the impossible.
He strikes me as much more soulless than Paul Ryan. I'm not sure who's more evil, but I'm positive McConnell is less of a soul.
Right. There's things that Paul Ryan wants besides, you know, immediate temporal power.
Yeah, Mitch McConnell's just been broken by time. He's just this ancient and bitter, like, get off my lawn kind of man. Like, there's nothing left in him to love or want. He just wants to spite people.
Just this completely hollowed out Nietzschean will to power.
I think, like, a full troll. Like, not even a will to power, just a will to spite.
Well, that definitely explains, you know, his actions from 2008 to 2016.
There has been a bit of a liberal backlash against this, with the base warning these two not to get that close to Trump. But on the other hand, this seems to be no lose territory for them. They're not giving up anything that they're not willing to do. They're not giving up wall funding. They're not giving up any democratic priorities. They're only getting what they want out of this, at least at this stage.
If they get something passed, yeah, I mean, that's still what remains to be seen, because I think, once again, anything that they do here, it still needs a majority to pass, and you know, the Democrats, by definition, don't have a majority to pass these things. You know, maybe they could get some defections from Republicans if Ryan and McConnell would allow these votes to come to a bill, or I'm sorry, these bills to come to a vote. But if they don't want to, they don't have to. And if they feel like it'll break their caucus, then they won't. As far as the politics, I mean, there's potential downsides. I mean, anytime Trump is seen to be getting things done, that makes him more popular and creates problems for Democrats down the road. I mean, they're taking back Congress in 2018 is probably pretty heavily dependent on Trump being as maximally unpopular as possible. And I don't know, maybe cutting these kinds of deals might make him more popular on balance. There's a possibility it could make him less just because it's infuriating the Breitbart far right. So it's tough to say.
Breitbart seems to have been pretty heavy-handed implying that it is. They've started a Twitter game of burning MAGA hats or whatnot. But it seems, by and large, Trump's voters are personally loyal to Trump, not to any particular policy. At least that's what shows up in the polls.
That's fair. I could certainly see that. But at some point, they had to be loyal to an issue, I would think. And immigration, that seems very central to the whole idea of Trump. And compromising on such a core thing, it, you know, maybe it's just completely personal to Trump and it has nothing to do with even, you know, being angry about having to press one for English. But it's certainly possible, you know.
Well,
I'm willing to wait and see.
I feel like given a couple more weeks of sustained Breitbart barrage, polls might change a bit right now, because Bannon hasn't been out that long. There hasn't been too much time for opinion to really sway, and not enough time for new polls to come out to really gauge that anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But in 2 weeks, if they keep it up, whether it's genuine or not, I think Trump supporters, that'll be telling as to whether or not they align with the propaganda or the man.
Exactly. I mean, these people were out there and they were racist long before Trump came on the scene and gave him a candidate to rally around.
Yeah.
You mentioned the pain in Congress that's been caused by some of these proposals. And we're starting to see the first indications. We discussed this briefly last week. The first indications that there are members of the majority who are opting not to have to go through that pain. We've been keeping, a bit of a retirement log. We discussed Reichert at one point before. It's starting to build upon itself at this point. We're up to, I think it's 6 or 7 confirmed retirements?
4 that are retiring in seats that are definitely blue. And will be likely to flip. But there are other retirements that are out there, whether they're people that are looking to run for higher office or just sitting out altogether. I mean, you do have some representatives, for instance, that are intending to run for Senate in the next election. But yeah, it's a growing list, and I think that's certainly a contributing factor. You know, this is really, if you wanted to get something done as a Republican, this would be the prime time to do it. And here we are, it's September, and I'm looking around and I'm not seeing a realistic, you know, far right tax proposal that's likely to be becoming law anytime soon. Obamacare is still the law of the land. And the president is talking about abandoning even his signature priorities on immigration. That's got to be very demoralizing if you're a conservative Republican in Congress.
Yeah, JJ, you had a wonderful little quip to this one, that it's just not as easy to screw the poor anymore.
Yeah.
It's getting harder to do the things they want to do, so why not just cut and run?
Yeah, I mean, all of these like cushy jobs where they don't have to run against anybody. They haven't been primaried in decades. Like,
yeah, the money they raise can go straight for them rather than having to go to a campaign consultant.
Right. I can't feel bad for these people at all. Yeah. I mean, I guess the only part of me that might feel bad is like if Steve Bannon like sick some like crazy person into a primary after these seats, then I'll feel a lot worse. But
yeah.
Right now, that's just, oh, tiniest violin.
Bye-bye.
There has been kind of some conflicting messaging about this. Democrats have yet to actually pick up a seat that they wanted to pick up in the national context. But they have swung the needle substantially. And they have been picking up seats left, right, and center in state legislatures. In fact, in New Hampshire, they just won a district that Trump carried by 16 points.
Yeah, actually, someone sent me a link to that the other day, but so far in terms of state legislative races across the country, looks like Democrats have picked up 6 seats in these local special elections, and Republicans have so far won none. So,
wow.
The state level, things are moving.
It reminds me that one of probably the most important things to carry forward if we want to enshrine competitive politics is that we need independent redistricting. A lot of these districts are gerrymandered to shit.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to ask, is this a redistricting year?
No, that'll be after 2020. But
okay.
There is a very important, and we actually briefly discussed it at one point, gerrymandering decision coming out of the Supreme Court very shortly.
Oh, yeah. That's right. The Supreme Court, they've not given an injunction against the Texas maps, I believe.
Yeah, so, but there's a whole different case out of Wisconsin, I believe.
Right.
Is going to be the serious opinion on this.
Yeah. But as far as redistricting and things like that, 2018 will be an important year. There are a lot of states where the governor's races are open. And they're going to be particularly important because usually the governor has a role in that process in collaboration with the state legislatures. So, for instance, Ohio, Wisconsin, I mean, those are the two ones that come immediately to mind. Trying to think of any others. Illinois, all these are Pennsylvania, the governor is currently a Democrat, but he's up for re-election. And so rather than face the situation where you had Republican trifectas in all of these states completely owning the redistricting process, if they can at least have something split, then you might have fairer maps or less ridiculously slanted maps. Like, for instance, again, Wisconsin, where I think, what was the statistic I saw that that Democrats were winning something like 52-53% of the votes statewide for the legislature, but Republicans had a lock on the Senate, like, you know, 65-70% of the seats. Just madness. Totally out of proportion to how people are actually voting.
California has a wonderful system on this, which is their Citizens mm-hmm. Redistricting Commission, and I would love to see that exported to other states. It's a fantastic, somewhat flawed, but much better than the system that they had before, which was partisan gerrymandering.
Yeah.
All right. Speaking of new jobs and the politicians that come up for them, our very own Jeff Merkley seems to be looking quite a bit like he's running for president. He's set to do, or did, excuse me, 6 events in the course of 48 hours in Iowa, including such traditional events as the corn feed, which is strange, but it is a keystone of American politics. Those Iowans really want to see you shake your hand and eat something from a farm with you.
Yeah.
Merkley's staking out an expressly progressive stance in this. He is one of the more liberal members of the Senate, but it seems like the progressive left is a crowded spot in this election.
Yeah, I don't think there's really anybody that is going to be explicitly, making the case for the center-right of the party. I mean, even I think the most, right-wing potential candidate, Governor Cuomo of New York, is going to be running, at least on paper, as a progressive. That's certainly what he's going to try and do. But yeah, it's going to split a lot of different ways. I mean, Merkley stands out a little bit. He's the only senator who endorsed Bernie Sanders last year. So he's got that going for him as far as his own personal credibility. But it's going to be hard to find room because I think just about every other potential candidate right now is already signed on as a co-sponsor for Sanders' Medicare for All bill, which he introduced this week.
That's a great discussion there. That quickly racked up, I believe, 15 Democratic co-sponsors, and even more have been piling on since then.
That's right. I think they're probably up to around 20 by now.
That's incredibly impressive. You shared a link, I believe, earlier this week with former Montana Senator John Tester, or was it Max Baucus?
Max Baucus
coming out of the woodwork to support single payer, which is something that sounds kind of ironic considering what happened back in 2008.
Yeah, he was the guy who kept the ACA bottled up for months and months and months and let the whole Tea Party madness fester while he was trying to get Republican buy-in for the ACA back in 2009. So, when people want to blame someone for there not being a public option with the Affordable Care Act, Max Baucus is probably one of the main culprits for that. But yeah, now here he is saying he's in favor of single payer.
What a dick.
Yeah. Helps to not be in Congress anymore, probably. But I can't say that. I'm super enthused for what Max Baucus has to say about healthcare.
It does show how the needle on this issue has moved quite a bit in just a very short time frame.
Yeah.
For sure. The power of Bernie is strong. It's pretty surprising.
Do people actually expect Bernie to run again in 4 years?
Or God, I hope not.
3 years now?
I think it's possible. I really do.
The guy was like 3 months away from being the oldest president we ever elected.
Yeah, well, we did get the oldest president we've ever elected.
I mean, yeah, true.
But
and we're all about setting records in presidential elections now. Right?
Yeah.
So we have the oldest one, so let's old it up again.
Even older. Oh, man, is there still a boomer around, maybe? But, yeah, I think
isn't Alan Hatch older?
I think he might be. At least he's been in the Senate longer, for sure. But yeah, I wouldn't rule it out. I think he'd probably rather go with a successor. But if he doesn't see one, then he might run. But yeah, I agree with JJ. I'd rather that he found a successor. It's very old at this point.
Every major candidate last year, between Sanders and Clinton and Trump, was ancient. Like, we have not had that old a crop of candidates in cycles and cycles and cycles.
I hear Biden's thinking of running, and he's even older.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
A Biden, little bit of time to pass the torch to the younger generation, guys.
Yes.
I want to throw
Biden
a couple.
Biden is technically younger than Bernie. He's 2 years
really?
Younger. Yeah.
I thought Biden was older. Huh.
No, 74. Bernie, 76. Orrin Hatch, 83.
Wow.
Oh, man. If only we could run Bird.
Get a shovel.
Oh,
God.
we have not taken much time to talk about these at all this week, so I am going to throw out a couple things that are going on right now or recently, and I guess we can just do some hot takes on them because we're only about 25 minutes into the episode.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see that Mueller got a warrant for Facebook?
Is this the story on I guess the bot Russian coverage or
yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Wow.
So Facebook gave some very kind of loose numbers to the House and the Senate. Mueller showed up with a warrant and got boxes of information.
Wow.
Oh shit.
Somebody points out too, in order for him to get a warrant, he has to show that he knows there's been a crime committed and that there's a high probability that he will be able to get the information to prove it. Something, whatever is going on with these Russian bots and these purchases, is serious enough that he was able to do that.
Wow.
It's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, I hadn't realized he'd gotten a warrant on that. I heard the story, but yeah, that is it's a very odd story too, you know, how it all came about. You know, and the answers just haven't been very forthcoming either.
Well, I mean, in the Russian bot story, yeah, like that's definitely a big deal. I mean, I remember, you know, during the election, there was all the talk conservatives were really pissed off because Facebook was censoring them.
And so still, you bitch about that, yeah.
Yeah, but then Facebook opened up the floodgates to, we found out later, terrible Russian bots, like spreading disinformation, all of this other horse shit. Like, yeah, if there's any tie to somebody on Trump's campaign for that, which, you know, probably just like a meet and greet with some Facebook douchebag.
Except they think that there's much, much more to the contact between them. These were, and nobody, I think, subscribes to this 100%. Obviously, Putin is a very smart man, and he's a master spy. He knows what he doesn't know, and he knows how to find it out. But some of the micro-targeting that these people doing these promoted posts were doing to affect the election were so knowledgeable about American politics and demographics that they really think it was somebody in the game. And more specifically, they think it's that super shady digital outreach thing that the Republicans had going on that Jared Kushner was working with extremely closely.
I was just going to say before you, like when you were halfway through with that, I was going to make some crack about how one of the other jobs that Jared Kushner has is he makes Russian bots. And we finished up with all that, and I'm like, well, shit, there goes my joke, and now it's real, it's scary.
Is it a joke? Shit. Yeah.
Damn it, Brock.
I'm sorry, man. Yeah, the other news coming out of that is that not only were these domestic political ads, but in a lot of cases, they were actually paid for with rubles. Like, not even going through a PayPal, you know, exchange or something. They were paid directly in rubles.
Oh, man.
The existence of the warrant, by the way, for the Facebook data was first disclosed by the Wall Street Journal last night, Friday night, and then it was confirmed by CNN today. So, yeah, Mueller walked into Facebook headquarters with a search warrant.
Well.
That is pretty awesome.
It makes you really... This is something we only discovered as, like, news consumers in the last week or so. Like, this has been a big story, but it's only been the last 4 or 5 days. If he's already been able to go through the rigmarole of getting these, going before a judge, obtaining the search warrant, I really think he's known about this for a while. I think Mueller really has some things on lockdown.
Yeah, he's definitely running a very tight shop. But, yeah, it would probably take, I would assume, weeks to put together all the necessary information to take it before a judge, if not months.
All right. The other thing I guess we can kind of poke at, because it's hilarious, that there is currently two different rallies going on in Washington, D.C. today.
Yes.
One of which is the Juggalo March, which has been endorsed by Roger Stone, our favorite Twitter troll of all time.
Wait. Stone's endorsing the Juggalo March, not just the Trump supporter march?
Oh, Oh, yeah, you didn't. I posted this like weeks ago.
Oh, I must have missed that. Yeah.
He had a whole Facebook thing about how this is so legit. Hashtag Faygo, hashtag Juggalos for Pence.
Wow.
Yeah, Roger Stone, no longer a closet Juggalo.
Yeah.
It's been my favorite thing. I don't see anything breaking apart. In fact, it seems rather small. Both the mother of all rallies that Trump has arranged and the Juggalo March on Washington combined total about 1,000 people from what I've read.
Let's see. I saw something in the Chicago Tribune from a little bit ago that said a couple hundred for the mother of all rallies, 1,500 Juggalos, and a couple dozen anti-Trump protesters. Wow. So just like a smattering of people.
That's tiny.
Yeah.
DC rally standards.
Yeah. That's, I mean, it definitely is sad. Not topping 2,000 total.
Yeah.
The DSA is present at the Juggalo rally handing out signs that say Faygo, not fascism, reflecting a Detroit favorite of the Midwestern band, and yes, socialist literature. So maybe something good can come out of this.
Good for them. You know, I guess that's it's good outreach.
God, yeah, an anarcho-socialist Juggalo. I don't want fucking Juggalos taming Marxism.
Oh, man. Oh, no. Seize the means of production, bitch.
Oh, my God. You see, the great Malenko is actually a metaphor for the struggles of the working class.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
We have only got one local story. I guess we can do it, but we're only at like the 30-minute mark, so this might be a quick episode here. The Oregon legislature has been dealing with a small scandal for the last couple months about nepotism and what it means for the state. Kind of the full extent of that has just leaked out. The Oregonian, using public records and FOIA requests, put together a list of all staff, every legislature, correlated them with family members, and figured out how much they're paying to people who they're related to. And the amount is actually kind of staggering. People are routinely paying their wife $35,000 a year. It's almost completely common. Two-thirds of staff have a family on payroll. Wives seem to be fairly common. Husbands in a couple cases. Sons, fathers. And substantial amounts, $30,000 to $40,000 each. I'm pretty shocked that it's brazen.
Yeah, I mean, that seems like it's really hard to see that as anything but an abuse of the powers of office to line one's pockets. I mean, maybe they're doing some work, but yeah, this is the scandal that, you know, we talked about the French election earlier this year. This is basically what brought down François Fillon earlier this year over there. But yeah, that's hard to see that as something that is okay.
Yeah, wow. Just like wife, like the first four wives, and then a daughter, and then wife, and then wife, and then father, mm-hmm. wife. Yeah, they're all okay. The lowest, there we go, 8,000 paid this year. That's the lowest number I've seen. Most of these are $10,000 to $30,000. That's damn. I mean, so what's the total math on all of this? Did they calculate that at the end of the story?
They have not. If I could go through the calculator and take a couple minutes, I could figure it out. But it's fairly substantial. Yeah. Actually, no, they do it at the beginning. $520,000 each year.
Okay. Wow.
And that's just for legislative staff. That's not counting nepotism in any other branch of the state government. Another scandal with that. And
there's another full investigation that needs to be done for that.
Yeah. Doesn't the Oregon legislature meet every other year? I was under the impression that it was like a every other year kind of thing. You know, how are they finding time to devote staff resources to that?
I don't believe it's every other year. because we've had some pretty substantive legislation go through last year and this year.
Okay.
I mean, maybe there's something to how they structure it or whatnot, but it seems like there's new bills passed every single
year. Might be shortened in non-budget years, maybe.
That's what I would imagine. Yeah.
Okay.
So this, I'm flabbergasted there's not rules against this. I mean, I've seen some pretty blatant nepotism in my life. Lisa Murkowski is a senator for that exact reason. But there is something so brazen about this, and very few of them even responded to to an email seeking comment from the newspaper.
Yeah.
I mean, what are you going to say, though, really? I mean,
yeah.
There's nothing that you can say that's possibly going to make
it. My son is the best staffer that I could come up with. I don't care that he's 19. Yeah. He does.
My wife always helps file some papers or something. Probably.
The one that even looks somewhat reasonable is this Gorsuch guy from Troutdale, which is just outside of Gresham here in Multnomah County. And he paid his daughter $13,000 over the course of 2017 as, you know, basically an intern. Filing questions or whatnot. That seems about minimum wage. That's something I'm less questioning of than the guy who's, like, hiring his wife for $42,383 a year or $50,875 a year as John Huffman from the Dalles is doing. This doesn't seem appropriate at all.
Yeah.
Just like Mitch Greenlick from Portland pays his wife, quote, "She's the best secretary I ever met. She works full time during the session and half time the rest of the time." Like, dude, give your wife a break from your, like, wrinkly ass.
That sounds like the type of guy who makes her call him the senator during lovemaking.
I believe it. Well, the representative. So he definitely has her call him the senator because that's his
explanation. Oh, yuck.
So I guess we'll talk some other breaking news up from your end of the world. You guys are without a mayor right now.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's an interim mayor. The city council president has stepped in for the mayor.
He's already stepped down, though. He said he doesn't want to continue on an interim basis. So, yeah.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, the city council is going to have to pick somebody else.
Good Lord. I don't read local news for like 2 days. We lose a mayor already. I thought he was going to stand in for like just a little bit. And then there was the issue of like once the space in between the time in which we vote to when the actual ballots are counted.
Yeah.
Let's see. Yep, declines mayorship. Oh, but Burgess wants it. Oh, the stranger repeatedly talks of Burgess as a giant douche nozzle.
Why would you want this? It's not like you're stepping up to higher power. You're not using this to gain some little bit of incumbent advantage to fight it out in the next election. You're literally just keeping the chair warm for like 2 or 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
You're making sure the city pays all its bills, and that's it.
Yeah, I don't understand why there's such an issue. Yeah, he took over for like, what, like 4 days? And I was like, okay, I'm good. Technically, I was mayor. I guess I'm done now.
Get a portrait in City Hall.
Yeah, I guess maybe that's what they'll do. Just everybody in city council is just going to take like a week as mayor. And we'll just rotate around and we'll have mayor roulette. And that seems very reasonable. Because Tim purchases a douche, so he can't have it the whole time. Just happen on some rotating scenario, and then we'll have Mayor Shama Sawant and she'll enact the liberal bourgeois new age fascist order, and we'll take over.
If I know anything about Seattle socialists, she's going to nationalize all the coffee shops.
Those people do need a union, bro.
That's a fairly good question. How is the unions doing in Seattle? Are they a force in this coming election? I'm used to seeing union endorsements as a big thing, but I have not heard any news out of Seattle on it.
They were relatively split in the primaries. I know there were quite a few that got behind Bob Hasegawa. Quite a few also split between Durkin and Farrell. But yeah, I'm not. I think they're probably mostly getting behind Durkin just on the assumption that she's going to win.
Yeah. Other than that, I really don't hear too much about the unions, despite being a union member. Yeah, it's.
I was gonna say there have been some incredible success stories for unions coming out of Seattle in the last few years. SeaTac has gone to almost entirely union employees and whatnot. Like big coups for the labor union movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah, not just again on the big, you know, the high ticket issues again, like the $15 minimum wage, but you know, that's the below the fold actual members paying dues. And I think the other big win was they won a court case for unionization of Uber employees in Seattle.
Yeah, so. That's true. And that's been a really contentious one nationally.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's shoot the shit, I guess, for a little bit. Dan, you mentioned something in the Facebook group chat about how... Kate Brown could instantly become the most liberal candidate in the race if she were to declare. Do you think that's realistic in any way?
Do I think she's going to run? I think probably not, but I'd be interested in seeing it happen. You know, I think that's a more interesting flavor of progressivism from the Northwest necessarily than, you know, Jeff Merkley, but either way.
I have reservations about Kate Brown because she was elevated by scandal. Those reservations have shrank a little bit. She has won a governor election on her own since. But it still, I believe, leaves a bad taste in a lot of voters' mouth to have somebody who only ascended to the job they did because somebody they were on the same team with was caught doing some shady shit.
That's fair. Yeah, I could definitely see that. Reservation, you know, and it happened kind of all of a sudden, you know, almost an accidental governorship. Everyone thought they were getting
Kitzhaber,
right? You know, and that mostly because Oregon's a state that's always going to vote for the Democrat at a statewide level, almost always. So,
oh, actually, on that note, here's something interesting from our one statewide elected Republican. Secretary of State says that he has information that roughly 56 people in Oregon voted illegally. Looks like he's trying to drive up some controversy around that.
Oh, God. Yeah,
probably
I guess.
All sovereign citizens.
Time to shut down vote by mail, I guess. Yeah. Oh, shoot, I shouldn't joke. He's probably thinking about that, actually.
Yeah, he's probably been gunning for that forever.
He'd have to get a law passed in the legislature. We have that as actual law. That's not just governor's prerogative.
So, Dan, what do you like about Governor Brown, then?
Not really anything in particular, actually. You know, it's mostly a style. You know, she seems very, very Pacific Northwest.
She definitely is.
Yeah.
She's very strong on progressive issues without being super preachy. She does eat a vegetarian diet most of the time, although she doesn't really get in your face about it. And she is the nation's first openly bisexual governor. I think it hits a lot of the Pacific Northwest checkboxes.
Isn't she to NPR at a very reasonable volume?
Yeah. Oh, most definitely. Most definitely. I was going to say, isn't she also making a big push for universal health coverage in Oregon State?
Yes.
I thought... something that she's pushing really hard.
Yeah, no, she wants to expand a Medicaid, Medicare-style system to all of it. She's actually looking to model that kind of after the Healthy SF, which is San Francisco's citywide public health care system.
And that's something states could do pretty much immediately to get universal health care. I mean, it's just a matter of coming up with the money to do it.
San Francisco paid for theirs through a restaurant tax. I don't know how well that would translate out, but the vast majority of the uninsured workers in the city were food service workers, so they decided to target that industry with taxes in order to pay for the public health insurance, and that's kind of how it's gone for the most part.
Sure.
I don't know how well that model would replicate to other places, but it's worked very well for San Francisco. Jay Inslee, we kind of derided a little bit in the same thing, talking about Kate Brown. Think he has any ideas to bring to the national table?
Let's see here. He's been very outspoken in taking on Trump, especially on immigration issues. So he's done a really good job of standing up for immigrants locally here against the administration, at least rhetorically. So I think that might be an issue that he would probably seize on. I think his likely successor, our current attorney general, has probably been doing a lot more of the heavy lifting on that. But Washington has definitely been at the forefront of a lot of those fights in the courts. So I think if he were going to take an issue and make it his, I think that would be it.
One of the biggest issues that your state has jumped in on has been the sanctuary city thing, which Oregon jumped in on too. And just today, I believe it was, a judge shut down Sessions' attempts to withhold public safety money from sanctuary cities. That's something I think we can all be pretty proud of on that. I don't know how long it'll last. It was just an appeals for a district court judge, but, you know.
Yeah, and ultimately these things end up in the Supreme Court, and I'm not sure what to think of how the Supreme Court's going to be ruling on a lot of things. I mean, it hasn't really changed in composition, just with, you know, Scalia switched out for Gorsuch. But the rulings so far have not been encouraging. It wasn't this week, I want to say, but probably the week before, that the court basically overturned all of the injunctions against proceeding with Trump's Muslim ban while waiting for oral arguments to occur later this fall. So at least they seem to be under the impression that there's a good chance they're going to let it go through.
All right. And I guess that more or less wraps it up. Oh, actually, you know what? I'll drop one more international story that we had discussed previously in the Facebook group. JJ, you and I talked about this a little bit, but Iraqi economist Kurdistan has just agreed to go forward with a referendum on independence this coming week. The vote in parliament was unanimous. There were abstentions. Notably, the chief opposition party believes in an independence referendum, but doesn't believe the time is now. So instead of voting against it, they just didn't vote. Which means the referendum has gone through unanimously. It looks like they're going to hold it. Iraq is pissed. Iran is pissed. Turkey has always thought of Iraq's Kurds as the good Kurds, and now they're pretty pissed too. The U.S. notably has, for the first time, kind of stepped on this, said that it shouldn't go forward and that it's distracting from the fight against ISIS. But it looks like they're pretty committed to having this vote.
Wow.
I'm
not surprised that they voted to do so, because of course they would. Because the Kurds have been screwed for 100+ years at this point in time.
Yeah, the reason there was a no-fly zone over Iraq was because Saddam Hussein kept trying to genocide these people.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, they're some of the worst victims of the Sykes-Picot Agreement, if I recall correctly.
They are the fourth largest ethnic group in the Middle East, and yet they've never been able to establish a permanent home.
Yeah, because they pretty much live in the space that is the border of four different countries. So, it, you know, because Churchill didn't care about the Kurdish people and was like, yeah, I'll just draw some lines over here. I was always surprised. I didn't even think that they had any standing against the Iraqi government was kind of my concern, but apparently none of that matters. Everything is good to go.
Yeah, they are fully autonomous.
I made the mistake of not thinking that they were actually an autonomous area.
They're actually one of the only relatively peaceful portions of Iraq for most of the later part of the aughts.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
Yeah, I make this point that they're the one relatively good functioning part of Iraq.
Oh, there we go. They got autonomy in 05. That's what it was. Okay.
Yeah, when we set up Iraq in our nation building exercise, we strived for a federal structure, and one of the big parts of that was giving Kurds more or less full autonomy. Mm-hmm. I mean, they even have their own National Defense Force.
Yeah. I just figured that my understanding of that previously, that was kind of like the reservation system in this country, and that it was like, yeah, you've got sovereignty, but also not really. Entirely what I assumed had happened to the Kurds. So this is just actual autonomy that is kind of surprising.
It's actually almost the exact opposite of the reservation thing. With Iraq's central government doing such a bang-up job against ISIS, it's actually been the Kurds that have been liberating a lot of nominally centrally controlled Iraq.
For and sure. And
just adding that territory to autonomous Kurdistan. Not like officially, but being like, yeah, well, right? Obviously like you guys can't like, run this, well, so we're just going to run
this. You were
the
ones that got this from ISIS and not you, so it's probably going to be our stuff and not yours.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, that's pretty rough.
So
5 more years and Iraq will be the size of Kuwait?
It's seeming pretty roughly like that. Between territory it's losing to ISIS in the west and territory it's, you know, the Kurds are picking up from ISIS in the middle. Yeah, the effective control of the Iraqi central government is shrinking.
Wow.
Now,
no, go ahead.
I was going to say, I don't think the question is whether or not this referendum will succeed. I think it's quite obvious it will. I think what's more interesting is if Kurdistan is going to try and keep the territory it picked up. Because there's some very valuable territory there, and territory that the Kurds feel like should be theirs. Kirkuk is a city not technically in autonomous Kurdistan, but it is a city where Kurds make up the largest ethnic group in that city, and it's one that the Kurds were able to protect from ISIS, and it's one that's been administered from Kyrgyzstan since, you know, ISIS became a thing.
Yeah.
I mean, and if they play their cards right and they have a really good diplomatic strategy and they have somebody on their way to the UN right now to like start laying the groundwork for an observer member state, like, yeah, they might be able to make a push on the Iraqi central government and actually get them to cede that territory.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Dan.
I was just going to say what I would expect has at least the rest of the world kind of shitting bricks about the idea of sovereign Kurdistan is that in addition to territory within Iraq, there's a fair amount of territory within Turkey that would historically be a part of an independent Kurdistan.
And Syria.
Yeah.
And Iran.
Just.
Yeah, exactly. Like, there's some big players would have to give up some turf.
A lot of, century-old.
A lot of those people have been buying a lot of weapons recently.
Mm-hmm.
So this is definitely something that's going to be interesting for the next couple weeks. I believe the vote is September 24th, which only gives them about a week. I might be wrong on that, but that's the number I was seeing last week. So.
Wow, yeah, that'll be really interesting.
All right. Well, I think that's going to do it for us. It's still kind of a short episode, but we got in more, and I don't want to, blab your guys' ear off.
Sure.
let's do what we're going to be looking at this week. And I'm actually going to have a twofer. I'm going to go first, even though I don't think anybody is going to steal mine. But there is a bit of a science fiction renaissance, at least a Star Trek science fiction renaissance going on. There are two shows launching. One is already launched. One will launch next week. The one that's already launched is not Star Trek, but it kind of is. Have you guys seen The Orville?
Is that the one with
Seth MacFarlane?
Yes, that's it.
It is a complete love letter to the Star Trek franchise from Kirk and Spock all the way up to TNG and Deep Space Nine. It's fantastic. It's definitely written with a bit of humor, although I wouldn't call it a straight comedy. It's a fantastic show to watch. There's only been one episode, at least that I've seen. And I enjoyed every second of it, if you want to watch it. It's wonderfully awkward in this way that makes it feel real while still, you know, holding on to that future utopia idea. I absolutely love it. And the other one is launching on CBS All Access, CBS's new premium service, and that's a true Star Trek series, Star Trek Discovery. It's going to be the anchor of CBS's new digital lineup. The first episode will air on, you know, on air, on TV. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of them will be available on CBS All Access in the U.S., or if you're anywhere else in the world, it will be on Netflix, but not here.
Hmm.
That's what I'm looking cool. at this week. I'm a huge nerd. I love science fiction, so this sort of thing is right up my alley. How about you, JJ?
I think I'm just going to keep following all of the what I consider the hilarious clucking over healthcare right now, over Bernie and everything else that's going on. You know, there's no price tag yet. And we can talk about this next week, of course, maybe in more depth. But yeah, I'm just kind of curious to see. It's just funny to watch the conversation happen again.
Yeah, it feels like we just had this conversation.
Yeah, we really just did.
Yep.
We had a chance to not fuck it up back then, but we did.
Yeah. Hopefully we do better this time.
We'll see.
Hopefully. All right, Dan, what are you following?
All right. Well, I've just got something that's chapping my ass this week, so I'll be Andy Rooney. So I've got not just one, but two hiring decisions that Harvard University has apparently decided to outsource to right-wing media. I posted on Facebook. I don't think I put it in the group, but Chelsea Manning had been offered a fellowship this fall, and it was withdrawn just based again on blowback and criticism, again, from the right-wing media, Fox News and those quarters. And earlier this week, another academic, Michelle Jones, who is apparently a well-regarded historian, she does have a bit of a checkered personal past. She spent some time in prison for killing a child that was conceived in rape. And she was a minor. So it's kind of a horrific crime, but the circumstances themselves are horrific. But she had been offered a fellowship with Harvard, and that was also denied this week, in addition to the Chelsea Manning fellowship. Again, not even over existing criticism from right-wing media, but on the fear that they would get criticized by Fox News. So they revoked her offer of fellowship as well. Meanwhile, starting this fall as visiting fellows at Harvard are not just Sean Spicer, but Corey Lewandowski, who was actually fired by Donald Trump for being too much of a loose cannon and physically attacking reporters, including one for Breitbart News. So good hiring decisions, Harvard. Way to go.
Yeah, keeping it classy.
Just as a small question here, did you read the letter of resignation from the former CIA director?
No.
No.
I'd have to look up his name. I forget it now. But there was a former CIA director who was a lecturer, a fellow of some variety without tenure at the Harvard School there, the Kennedy School of Government. And mm-hmm. he resigned his post over the hiring of Miss Manning. And wow. while I disagree with that, I actually thought it was a very well-written resignation letter. And he went out of its way to say that it had nothing to do with the gender issues and that transgender Americans of all sorts should, you know, have the full rights and protections of the government. Really laid out a very progressive political vision, but then went on about how, you know, he has issue with the completely inspecific leaks that were just, you know, fire hosed out and he couldn't stand by and do it. I think he's a douchebag and that there's nothing wrong with hiring Chelsea Manning. But if you have to take that disagreement to the point of quitting, doing everything you can to make it not a personal attack and more about the person's actual qualifications, I thought there was a little bit of a golf clap to be had for that, because too many on right-wing Twitter have just made this a transphobic nightmare.
Yeesh.
Yeah.
All right. Well, with that said, I think that's our show for this week, guys. We are doing this on Saturday, not Sunday, so I'll have this posted tomorrow. We'll miss these Sunday shows, but hopefully you'll have an easier time editing it since I'm off on Sundays.
Hey, great.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. All right. I'll see you guys later.
All right.
Take care, guys.
Have a good one.